Good morning. Oh, they finally got what I've been saying I wanted above the door of the meditation hall. Wonderful. I think that's about as good as a description of meditation as you'll ever come across, isn't it? Resistance is futile. This journey back to where we already are. In essence, is nothing more than being the unborn, becoming conscious of itself. That's the entirety of the journey. In India, they have this term that probably most of you are familiar with, Sat Chit Ananda. And sat is usually translated as being. But being only if it's understood as being beyond being. Is being in the sense of the mystery of your own being. The unborn nature of yourself. In contrast to the born nature, what you can see, taste, touch, feel, reflect upon, that's your born nature. Being is unborn, the essence. And sat is usually translated as consciousness. But this really, in my view, as a translation, kind of misses the mark. Because chit is not really so much consciousness. Chit is when being is conscious of itself. It's not just consciousness as such. It's when being is conscious of itself. That's chit. When we awaken from the dream of appearances, from what is born, then chit arises, consciousness of being. The mystery has become conscious of itself. And how does the mystery become conscious of itself? Basically, by being quiet. That allows it to return. As long as you're paying attention to your noise, then consciousness is in relationship with internal noise, or dilemma, or drama. And so when we become quiet, then consciousness is no longer in relationship with noise. And it naturally slips into consciousness of being. The mystery becoming conscious of itself. That's spiritual awakening 101. That's when you realize what you are. But it's not a personal realization. It's not you in the sense of you as a person, you as an ego. It's you as being, you as the unborn. The universal unborn is what wakes up. So chit is when being becomes conscious of itself. Ananda is also just usually translated as bliss. And although that has a truth to it, like all things, they are much more inclusive and much deeper than simple translations usually make them appear. And so the mind hears a word like bliss and it thinks it understands. But bliss is really just a pointer that when being becomes conscious of itself, there is a spontaneous great tranquility and a great joy, a feeling of happiness, contentment. It's the natural experience that being has when it becomes conscious of itself. It's happy, loving, content. So we can have a taste of any of these experiences, or we can really immerse ourselves in the depth of this truth. So when we turn our attention upon itself, when we turn awareness upon itself, or consciousness upon itself, and inquiry is just one of the ways that we do that. What am I? Is not meant to get a nice answer. It's meant to simply turn consciousness upon the unborn. Because when you ask the question, and you look inside, there is nothing there. Behind the thoughts and ideas, there is a vast space there. That vast space is the unborn. It's not a thing. It's not an idea. It has no age, no gender, no beginning, no end. If you look at it from a distance, even the distance of a single thought, all you'll experience is emptiness. All you'll come back with is, there's nothing there. That's like putting your toe in a pool of water and thinking you know what it's like to swim, or how it feels to immerse yourself. So just taking a quick glance and realizing there's nothing there when you look in to find your true self is not nearly the depth of experience that's possible when that emptiness, that unborn, wakes up to itself. That's very different than just experiencing emptiness, knowing it, looking at it. When you give yourself to it in silence, then the unborn can wake up. And you can realize you are the unborn. You are that vastness. Self-luminous. Self-luminous means conscious. All of a sudden, that space becomes conscious. It's not just the thing that you're looking at. Now you're looking from it. And that space has become conscious. It has awakened. Space or being has remembered itself. And that too can be a momentary thing that your mind then tries to grasp and then claim and then tell itself, I, mind, have had an awakening. And as soon as it grasps it, it's gone. Have you noticed? As soon as it claims it in any way for its own, it disappears. Because it's back in duality. Me and that. How can you grasp what you are? It's as silly as your hand trying to grasp itself. Does it gain anything by clenching its fist? Just tiredness. After a while, pain. White knuckles. There's nothing to be grasped by your hand grasping for itself. There's nothing to be lost by your hand not grasping for itself. So as soon as the mind claims even a glimpse beyond the veil, for itself it is gone. And the more you see that, the more there's an invitation to let go into that inner mystery, to stop grasping it, for the mind to stop trying to claim it, or hold it, or continue it, or take it out into life. All these ways of the mind goes back into a dualistic relationship with experience. It becomes the attainer, the one who's grasping, the one who's trying to hold on, the one who's trying to take this into life. All of that dualistic nonsense that the mind creates. And so if you've ever tried to grasp your own realization, you know the futility of this. And of course, the futility of it is the deepest teaching. Because only as you realize the futility of grasping what can't be grasped, do you let go of grasping what can't be grasped. And only when you fully let go of what can't be grasped, do you realize that that which can't be grasped can't be lost. Any more than your hand can lose itself when it lets go. Your hand does not gain itself by clenching itself into a fist, and it does not lose itself by opening the fist. Only when you finally let go of trying to grasp your deepest realization does it remain. And that's the invitation into a deeper state of surrender. And you start to find in your own experience that everything that takes you away from that surrender is an illusion, is an idea, is a concept, is a fixation in the mind, in your psychology, in your emotional body. Everything that would take you away from that knowing, that experiential knowing, is itself an ephemeral illusion. Quite unnecessary, quite unreal. And the more you see that, the more this letting go happens. And as you let go, you'll have moments when being is conscious of itself, and when being is conscious of itself, it feels good. That's ananda. It feels good. Being rejoices in becoming aware of itself. It feels very good, which becomes also its own problem, because what feels very good, you try to grasp again. It feels so good. I want to feel that way all the time. And then the mind's gone back into duality. I, that's the personal, isn't it? I want to feel ananda all the time. Well, I, you don't get to. You are what keeps getting in the way. And that's the trickiness of all of this. And so as you see that the one that grasps even pleasure is also the recreation of a dualistic sense of self, is itself the experience of suffering. To grasp that pleasure is the perfect way to suffer. It's the quickest way to suffering. Yeah? Grasp at pleasure. And so the more you see this, the more you surrender grasping at pleasure and you let yourself be taken by this mystery, by this silence, by the unborn. And of course, as you do this, as this is happening, all of your, what I call your holdouts, those parts of yourself that basically don't want to let go, they want attention, they will arise. Whatever's left of your neurotic stuff, your grasping, your blaming, your judgments, your ideas about how it should be, or others should be, or anything should be, whatever the attachment is will arise. Whatever's left will keep being dredged up from the bottom of consciousness. Most people will then want to escape from this dredging and go back to Ananda. I don't like this dredging. I don't want the muck to be dredged up from the bottom. I just want to feel good. But alas, you try that for a while, and it doesn't work. And you feel good, but the dredging continues. You'll notice that God pays very little attention to you, to your complaints, which is a very fortunate thing. If the divine influence paid attention to our complaints, nobody would get anywhere. And each thing arises to be seen, to be seen, to be empty. Empty of reality, empty of the promise it keeps, the promise in any of one's fixated points of view, whatever you're holding on to, whatever's unresolved, there's always some promise that if you could get your way, things would be so much better. If you could be understood, you'd be happy. If you'd be loved, everything would be okay. If your mind got the final understanding, then everything would be good. And so it goes. If you got what you, if you would get now what you never got, what mommy and daddy were never able to give you, if you got it now somewhere, then you everything would be okay, and then you'd let go. But it's not true. If you got it all, you'd figure out something else you need. And so you see through it all. As it arises, you meet it, acknowledge it, don't move or run away. Don't explain away, don't spiritualize away, don't psychologize it away. Just be there as the presence that allows it to arise. See it, experience it. Let it unfold of its own accord. Always knowing the underline, the name of the game is to let go. The name of the game is surrender. Insights, they're only there so you can surrender. That's the only reason they're there. If they help you let go, they've served their purpose. If they become more knowledge that goes into your memory, they've just got become another obstacle in the way. And we surrender spontaneously into the truth of our being until, as the great Christian mystic Meister Eckhart said, we want what we are and we are what we want. It's a simple statement, but it's very vast. Even the first line, we want what we are. When you get to the point, the place where you want what you are, that's total surrender. When you actually want what you are, and you don't want anything other than what you are. You want what you are, and you are exactly what you want. And nothing else. When you come to that place inside, you don't develop that place. You don't manufacture it. It's not phony. When you find that place and you come to that place inside yourself, when you want what you are, and you only want what you are, when everything else is seen very clearly to not be ultimately satisfactory, you can get all the praise, all the love, all the agreement, all the everything, but it's not really what you want. It's what you think you want. It's not really what you are. And when you come to see that, then nothing will be enough except what you are. Then spontaneously you start to want only what you are. And then you find that what you are is what you want. That's the one's flight back to itself. And the more it comes back, the more you come back to your nature, the more tranquility there is, the more spontaneous joy there is, the more you naturally have just, you just emanate a love for no reason. You don't know why you love. You don't know why you love things that you don't even like. It's just your nature. It's just the nature of being. It's nothing personal. Now, we don't actually just come back to what we are, to our true origin, just so we can come back to our true origin. There would have been no point if it was only about coming back to our origin, because we began at our origin. That's where we started from, our origin. So to take this whole ridiculous journey going absolutely nowhere, simply to come back to your origin, as beautiful as it is, and Sat-Chit-Ananda-full as it is wonderful. But it's not the final thing. It's not what it's all about in the end. Because in that place, then we die to who we were. And not only do we die to who we die to everything, all the demands we placed on everything, on oneself, on others, on the world, everything dies with us to enter into our innermost being. Or as Meister Eckhart said, that place where distinction never gazed. Where you are what you want and you want what you are. And from that place where this death takes place. Now, of course, everything I've talked about, you can taste at any one time. Lots of people get tastes of this. They stick their toe. They put their toe in chit, the awakening of their true nature. Then they put their little toe in Ananda, the bliss and joy of that. And, you know, a lot of people, they're just satisfied. Yeah, a little taste of truth, a little happiness. Okay, I'll go on about being me and pull happiness out of my pocket when I really get desperate. They don't think that way because it'd be a little embarrassing, but, you know, that's actually their relationship. So you can have tastes, or you can eat a full meal. It's different. The food's not different, but it's a whole different experience. It's up to you, whatever you want. You can have a taste. Most people have a taste. Most people only want a taste. To tell you the truth, most people only want a taste. Because ultimately, most people want a taste, but they want to remain in control. They want their life. Right? They want to be enlightened and have themselves in the center of existence at the same time. In the end, that's, you know, that's what it comes down to. Not that it actually works, mind you. It doesn't work. It keeps you seeking forever, right? Seeking to be enlightened and you at the same time. In fact, it's kind of cute to watch. Morbidly cute, you know? Sort of. Kind of a guilty pleasure, you know? Like those movies you know you shouldn't like, but you do. The ones you don't tell your neighbors that you really like because they weren't nearly highbrow enough or complex enough or intellectual enough or whatever. But when and if we really let go and we really realize that we are what we want, and most importantly, that we want what we are. Just because you realize that you are what you want doesn't necessarily mean that you will therefore want what you are. It depends on how much you let go. But when we do, when it happens, that's when there's a certain death and rebirth. When we've died to who we're not. Awakening isn't a death-rebirth thing, by the way, necessarily. Awakening is peering behind the veil. It's knowing who you are. It's not really a death thing. Not really. You might have to go through a certain experience of death to get there. But the much deeper, really, real death is a real death into what you are, that you actually want what you are, and you don't want anything else. Or you don't want anything else more than you want what you are. Maybe that's more accurate. You'll want all sorts of things. You'll have all sorts of things you like and pleasures, but when push comes to shove, when you actually want what you are, more than anything else, then something really significant has happened inside. And that becomes a death, because at that point, it is a death to want only what you are. It's a death. You are ceasing to be what you were. Namely, a moving, living verb that says, I want something other than what I am. Right? When this lets go, and you are what you want, and you want what you are, there's a certain death. There's a certain finality to it. You feel it. You know it. You sense the ending of it. It's not something you can conveniently go back from. It's not a reversible thing. You can taste that state, you can touch upon that state, and you can go right back into wanting anything else but what you are. But when you really let go, you know that's it. It's not returnable, it's not refundable. And then you find something very curious, that you just don't sit there enjoying the bliss of your being forever. You could. But you realize that's not the fulfillment. That just about the time you've completely let go into the bliss of your being, into the happiness, tranquility, into actually wanting only what you are, then spontaneously something shifts inside you. And what shifts inside of you is you no longer... The joy becomes to be what you are. not just to enjoy what you are or to want what you are and nothing else, but to be what you are. And so it's the birth of an active life. Does that make sense? There's an activity. All of a sudden, the whole thing has been about a return into the source. And then it all sort of turns around. And now the greatest joy is not simply to return to the source and bask in the gloriness of your own being, but it is to actually be what you are. As an action, as a verb, as just not because it's a good idea or spiritual or noble, because it's the nature of spirit, it's overflow. Is it spirit naturally over? When it has returned, it overflows. That's the movement. It turns into something active. Again, not because it should, but because it does. It comes back, it becomes active, right? Ramana Maharshi sits in his cave for 15 years, letting the bugs eat his legs. He is absorbed in Satchit Ananda, in the bliss of being, so much so that he could care less if he lives or dies. It just doesn't matter because he knows, well, it doesn't matter. And all sorts of people came to him in that time and tried to coax him out of his little cave for all sorts of very good reasons. His dear poor mother tried to coax him out of the cave when his father died. Didn't get him out. Didn't get him out of the cave. Didn't get him off the mountain. Didn't get him to budge. Well, after 15 years of that, all of a sudden, guess who starts to walk out of the cave? Ramana Maharshi walks out of the cave. Hey, folks, anybody got any questions? Something has happened. You see, before that, it didn't matter if anybody had questions. It didn't matter who was outside. It didn't matter why they wanted it. It didn't matter that his own father died and his mother was begging him to come to the funeral. It just didn't matter. Something got him to come out. Something changed. Now spirit was not just basking in the bliss of its own being, but it was this next movement, it was being. Being as a verb, as an activity, as a deep engagement in life. It didn't mean he ran out and, you know, started disco dancing and dating. Although that would have been really interesting, wouldn't it? I know he doesn't wear pants, Mom, but he's not a freak, really. He's very, very nice, you know? He's okay. But an engagement nonetheless, a total engagement nonetheless. Somebody who hid in a cave the whole time basically made himself, in many ways, a public figure most all day, every day long. And so this, the deepest nature becoming an activity, this overflow, this outflowing happens. And when this outflowing is authentic, it's just a natural overflow of our being. It's not activity for the sake of activity. It's because it's an outflow of our being, an outflow of our, goodness. There's much more of it than you'll ever need. And so we return only to give back. Not to stay in a place where we simply hoard feeling really good. Feeling really good at a certain point becomes quite irrelevant. It's not the point. Now, in our culture, of course, this gets much more complex. I mean, it's the same movement. It's a very simple thing in the broader arc of it. But in people's actual lives, it's much more complex because you're probably not going to have the great good fortune to sit in a cave for 15 years, are you? Most people get to sit in the bliss of their being for about, 20 minutes, or if you're lucky, 5 days at a retreat, and all of a sudden, you are back in a place that is asking for your engagement, right? Almost immediately. And so it's a little bit more interesting than as I just described, isn't it? It can be a bit more challenging than it appears when just a nice discourse is given on it. You come back and you rest in the bliss of your being, and then when you're ready in your own good time. But it doesn't work that way here, does it? Nothing's listening to your good time. A knock comes on your door very quickly and very soon. You're asked to engage in very practical, very daily things. Which is actually a good thing in a way, because it keeps us from becoming overly attached to the unborn. Because one can actually become attached to that. And so it's really a journey that's going nowhere. It's going to where you are and what you are. But just because it's not going anywhere doesn't mean you don't take it. You're already on it. You've been on it since before you were born. It's not a choice. Everybody's on it, whether they know it or not. And so what I'm speaking of here, I'm always a little hesitant before I give one of these kind of nice comprehensive kind of talks, because there is a great danger in this sort of talk, or any talk, is that the mind fixates on what's being said. It's very important to realize that I am not talking from a fixated place, or trying to get across concepts so that one actually remembers these and tries to stuff their experience into the concepts. I'm simply putting into words a deep inner experience that I've had, that anybody who've ever really walked the journey has had. It's just a way of reporting back, putting into words and ideas something that's actually an experience. So it's not philosophy. It's certainly not theology. It's experience. It's giving words to something that can't be spoken. It's actually something that in its own way is happening within everybody in this room. In some way, you're at some point along in this journey going now here. That's why you're here. And as I often say, the shortcut of this journey, not that there actually is a shortcut, you can try. There might be. You never know. The shortcut of the journey is to give up your argument with what is. That's the shortcut. If you can do that, great. If you can't do that, oh well, you'll have to work your way through it. But if you know, underline, there is no such thing as winning your argument with what is. There's no such thing as winning your argument with yourself. You don't win. You don't win your argument with others. You don't win about how they should be. You don't win your argument with life. It is what it is. It bumbles along and it's not listening. And you certainly don't win your argument with God. Whatever your concept of God is, you don't win your argument. course, we only have an argument when we see ourselves as separate. All arguments arise out of seeing ourselves as separate. No separation, no argument. No argument, no problem. But who wants no problem? Do you really want no problem? I mean, it sounds good, doesn't it? But do you really actually want, like, nothing to get over, nothing to accomplish, nothing to do? Do you really want where it doesn't matter if you're seen or agreed or loved or what? Do you really want to have whatever you wanted be totally unimportant? I mean, who wants that? You see, so nobody that's actually honest can be a good salesman for enlightenment, because it's like, whatever you want, you're not going to get it. What you will get is that you'll realize that you don't really want what you thought you wanted, and you don't really need what you thought you needed. What you really wanted is only what you are, and what you really needed was to know what you really are, and that's all. And the deepest joy is not to be known, but it's to know. It's not to be recognized, but to recognize. It's not to be met, but to meet. It's not to be loved, but to love. It's not to be acknowledged, but to acknowledge. It's just the deepest joy. There's nothing saintly about it. There's nothing holy about it. There's nothing virtuous about it. It's a true thing. It's who you really are. It's the deepest joy. We need to stop making all this stuff so special. It's not special. It's just reality. As I said, reality's not special. Illusion's special. You know, go to Vegas. It's special. There's lights, there's fake stuff everywhere. It's entertaining, it's special, it's impressive, it's wow. Right? That's why people go. Walk out into the woods, look at the sunset. It's not special. It's sublime. But that's different. It's beautiful. You touch upon something you can. That's inexpressible. Okay, let's look. This is one I get almost every retreat. My answers to this question are getting simpler, more to the point, and therefore probably less tolerable. Why am I being asked to bow to a chair, the room, in unison with the group at set times? I can only invite you to put your hands together, see how you feel, see what it elicits in your being. And if you get sensitive enough and you'll feel what it elicits simply by putting your hands like this, it changes your consciousness. If you do it without thought, it elicits something. Everyone has to find out for themselves what it's there to elicit. It's not about doing it because everybody else does it. It's not about doing it because you were asked to do about it. It's not about anything other than an invitation, unify your hands, and it might bring just a little taste of a unified heart, unified mind, just by doing this. If you just go, I'm just doing it because I'm supposed to do it, you haven't unified anything. You know? So it's an invitation. What happens? It's great for Americans, too. We want to know. What am I doing? What am I getting out of this? What's the return on my investment? But don't get me wrong, I understand. I had the same questions. Man, when you go into Zen like I was in Zen, I mean, you bow till you can't even see straight. I mean, we would, in our retreats, we'd wake up for 4:30 in the morning, walk into the meditation hall and do 108 super fast bows all the way to the ground. By the time you'd done, your legs would be shaking and your back would be in spasms. There's no time to wonder, why am I doing this, when you're... Afterwards, there is. Hopefully, you might find out quicker than I did. Took me about 4 years to find out. Took me about 4 years to put my hands together in an innocent way. And it elicited something. It woke something up, just the physical act of it. And it was inexpressible. And so I'll leave it that way, inexpressible. I have been a Zen practitioner for some time. Are the forms, rituals, and rigorous sesshins helpful or hindrances to the way-seeking path? Are they helpful or hindrances? Yes. Where are you, Eric? Hi. Come on up, Eric.
Hello again.
Hello.
I agree. They're both helpful and a hindrance. It's a practice to experience some of the things you described.
You can. Right. The problem with what I saw when I was, you know, doing a lot of that. I mean, it can happen here too. It's our attitude with which we engage, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of. We always have to look at the hidden attitudes that we bring and the hidden attitudes that tend to flow in whatever group we're in, right? Including this one. The sort of hidden attitude, the hidden ideas, the hidden assumptions. And, you know, in Zen, there's often this sort of hidden attitude and hidden, sort of a worship of effort. Self, you do it for yourself, within yourself, for yourself. And you make this great effort, and you sit, and you break your knees like nobody else can on any other path, and somehow you're going to break through the gateless gates. That attitude sort of buys into a deep-seated illusion, which is the truth is somewhere over there, that it's earned with great earnest sitting and meditating and striving, that's what's necessary. That illusion, if you believe it, that will become your reality. You ever notice? Whatever we think becomes what's real for us.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes. Now, when we drop that, if we can drop that. See, the Buddha nature is not something over there that we find. It's not an ideal. It's actually what we are. And what we are means right now. With crappy meditation, you are that. With great meditation, you are that. It doesn't matter. It's what you are now. So a lot of people in lots of traditions, even here, can get caught in this idea that I'm going to come through spiritual awakening, through perfecting some sort of meditative practice. This is one of the deepest seated illusions in spirituality. It's been around for thousands of years, and it seems to continue unabated against all evidence that it rarely works. Right? Put 1,000 people together, have them meditate 15 hours a day, come back 5 years later. How many of them are abiding in non-dual awakened consciousness out of 1,000? You'd be lucky if you find 5 or 10, right? If it's a business, it'd be out of business. Why we don't ever look at this again and go, wait a minute. It occasionally works, once in a blue moon, right? But occasionally, you know, people fall off bar stools, hit their head on the floor, and wake up too. We don't therefore do all hop up on bar stools and throw ourselves onto the floor, right?
No.
We don't do like Ramakrishna did when he drove himself to a state of near insanity and was just about to thrust a dagger into himself before he woke up. Therefore, we don't come to retreats and give everybody daggers at the door and say, now your idea is to get to the point where you're just about to kill yourself, and just before you shove the dagger into yourself, you might wake up. We don't try to reproduce these things, right? Because they would seem silly or dangerous. But we try to reproduce things that are just as silly and have even more of a failure rate. Which isn't the problem of meditation at all. It's not the problem with meditation. Meditation's not the problem. Sitting's not. If it was the problem, we wouldn't do any of it. It's the attitudes that we bring to it. The biggest barrier is getting beyond then and getting all of your attention into right now. What are you right now? You right now are a mystery unto yourself, are you not?
Yes.
Right now.
Yes.
You don't have to meditate.
No.
You come in the door that way. I meet people who've never meditated, and I go, you're a mystery to yourself right now, are you not? They go, uh-huh. Actually, you're lucky, because a lot of people have been meditating for years. I'll say, you're a mystery to yourself right now, aren't you? And they'll go, I'm consciousness. And you can see they have no idea. They don't know if that's true or not, right? So that can actually be much more problematic. You got a bunch of concepts in your head. But you're a mystery to yourself right now.
Yes.
Yes. That's what you have from the very beginning, right? The great master Bankei said, you have the unborn. Your parents, when you were born, you were born into the unknown as the unknown. It was your gift, the unknown. What am I? Wow, I don't know. Why don't you know? If I ask you, what is your hand like? You could tell me, right?
Right.
Five fingers, fingernails. Flesh, blood, funny lines that people read and interpret in strange ways. Easy to report back, right?
Yes.
Piece of cake.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
If I could say, gee, do you wear glasses? You go, yeah, there they are. You reach right up and grab them, right?
Just checking.
The simple stuff. Good. Good for you. Always check first. And we say, what are you? Wow, wait a minute. Well, there's ideas about what I am, a lot of spiritual nonsense in my head about what I am, a lot of thoughts about it, a lot of ideas, a lot of images, a lot of everything.
I really don't have a clue.
There you go. Because when you turn inside and you look for that true self that everybody in Buddhism is looking for, right? Even though the Buddha said there is no self, you're looking for your true self. And you look inside and oops.
There's nothing.
Yes.
There's emptiness.
There's nothing there.
Yeah.
There's emptiness. And what do you do when you see that there's nothing there, that there's emptiness?
It's scary.
It's scary. Well, of course it's scary because you don't understand it, right?
Right.
You don't know anything about it. What's there to know about emptiness?
Nothing.
So instead of being scared, letting yourself be scared, feeling the fear of emptiness. What do you do?
Meditate.
There you go. Gee, I think I'll do another session. I think I'll go to another retreat. Maybe then I won't have this fear of emptiness. Right?
Right.
Which means you've run right into the door, right? The gateless gate. You've come right to the gateless gate. It's right there in front of you. You look inside. I don't know who I am. Why don't you know who you are when you look inside? Because you don't find anything. Boom, you're at the gateless gate. You really don't find anything. There's nothing there. And it shocks you, and your mind doesn't know what to do with it. And it throws all sorts of ideas in there, but still, it's still empty, isn't it?
Yes.
And you don't know what to do with it. And so we try to do end runs. I won't really pay attention to this. I'll meditate. I'll really try to calm my mind. I'll do that. I'll try to break through the gateless gate. I'll do anything but be right here, right now, with the real invitation, which is you look inside, there's nothing there. You think, or have thought, or might imagine, that somehow you have not come across the truth, so you must keep seeking. This emptiness couldn't be. Couldn't be. Couldn't be. Couldn't be it. I mean, there's nothing there, is there?
No.
Couldn't be it. Couldn't be the Buddha's enlightenment, could it? Couldn't be. Not this. Please, anything but this.
Yes, that's you stated it. You stated it right on the head there. That's
right.
My mind is telling me that this can't be.
Right, but it is. Like only every time you look,
it's yes.
There's the Heart Sutra, right?
Yes.
Form is empty. So, Mr. Form, what's your name?
Eric.
Okay. Form name Eric. Form looks in, finds emptiness, right?
Yes.
There's the Heart Sutra right there.
Yes.
Form is emptiness. Hello, empty. Form. Look inside, see what you are. There's nothing there. There's the first part of the scripture right there. You see it. You realize it. Form, wow. Form is empty. Eric is nothing.
Wow. That's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. That's apparently enough for now. So my suggestion would be, instead of looking for nothing, or wonder, walk around just saying, what is it like to be nothing? Not what is it like to think about nothing, to conceptualize it, to philosophize it. None of that. That's nonsense. What's it like to be nothing? Because it's right there, isn't it? What's it like to be nothing? How old is it? Does it have an age? Does it have a gender? Does it have a beginning? Like your hand begins at the tip of your finger. Does emptiness have a beginning? Can you find it? Does it have an end? And so on, just like this, to take you into the lived experience of the nothingness, so that you're literally experiencing yourself. Form looks in, meets nothingness. Form pays attention to nothingness. Form realizes it is nothingness. Nothingness isn't just something you're looking at. Nothingness is what's looking. Do you see? That's what's looking at me right now, right? It's nothing looking through your eyes. We've told ourselves this delusion. I, Eric, I, Aja, I, me, I'm looking through these eyes. They're mine and I'm the one looking. No, not an experience, is it? It's not true. Nothing is looking. Nothing is conscious. Nothing is awareness. Nothing is about as awake as anything will ever be. just like that. Okay. Yes, come on now.
Hi, I'm Rick.
Good morning, Rick.
Morning.
Welcome.
Thanks. You say it's not returnable, not refundable. Can't go back.
Not ultimately, no. You can't really go back, no.
That's one of the... That's just one angle of the million concepts that kind of been floating around here for the last day or so in my head. That's scary.
Of course it's scary. Because it's unknown, right? It's just unknown.
And you don't... All I'm left with is assuming what that means.
Yes, and it's not... One can assume and imagine, but all the assumptions and imaginings are just imaginings. You cannot imagine what it's like to no longer imagine. You can't imagine. That's why I say... Everything you think enlightenment is, that tells you exactly what it's not. Every definition, every idea you have, it's not that. It can't possibly be that. You can't possibly be that. You can't possibly know. So, of course, the mind then projects what it must be like. But that projection is coming from where? The known or the unknown?
It's just guessing.
Yes, it's just the known, throwing
and
itself
into
the unknown.
It can create a real nice fantasy of it, or it can create a real horrible one.
Right.
And like the story of the guy in the cave?
Yes.
His mom's begging him to come to the funeral?
Yes.
I'm thinking, well, that's not very cool. Right? I don't want to get so open that I'm hurting my mother. You know, that's in a sense it feels callous.
Sorry, you don't have the choice.
But you see what I'm looking at? I'm standing on the diving board.
I know exactly
thinking,
what you're looking
whoa,
at.
Whoa, that's the, maybe that water's not so groovy.
Yeah. Right.
You know, it's
that's why I
toes
call,
okay.
But, yeah, that's yeah. Why I say enlightenment's a totally irrational act. Nobody does it because they think, oh well, this is going to be great for me. I mean, they start, they get little taste, they get a little involved, but nobody lets go because they think, oh, you know what? The real impulse is not an impulse of self-interest. Self-interest is there, but the deepest impulse is simply, I must know. It might scare the hell out of me. I must know. I might end up in ways that I'm afraid to end up, but whatever, I got to know. That's the real impulse. You just got to know. In that sense, it's irrational, right? Because there is no promise to that impulse. It's not an exchange. It's not let go and you'll get what you want. It's I got to know. I have to find out. Period. Scary? Maybe. Will I get what I want? Who knows? Will it all end up good? Who knows? I can tell you, of course it ends up good. Truth is only good. It can only be good. But that doesn't help anybody at the moment.
Well, then, and it's also, you know, it's about trusting you.
Right.
I don't even know you.
Right.
I mean, I mean, that's part of the dialogue.
Yes.
You know, you appear to know a lot about it from your experience. And
it's worked out just fine.
You've got an innocence about you and an openness, which is appealing. But I don't know you.
You do.
I don't know what you do back on the ranch. You know?
This is my ranch, friend. You don't know what I do away from the ranch, but this is the ranch.
You know what I'm saying.
But I know, yeah. But what I'm saying is you do know me. From the mind's point of view, we think I know you when I know what you do. When I know how you hang out, when I know what you do in your spare time, when I know what you like, when I know, you know, all these ideas about, when I know all that, then the mind thinks it knows each other. That's how egos bond. But we don't really know each other that way. You already know me. You already said so yourself. That's the innocence. That's not just me. It's not mine. In any way, it's not mine. It's our true nature. Innocence, openness, a natural clarity, a love, a sincerity. That's our being. That's what emanates from our being. When we know that about each other, we know each other. The exteriors, that's not to know somebody.
That's definitely, that's a part of my experience, is feeling that and feeling a familiarness and a comfort.
Right.
Or something. But there's still that element of not knowing. To really become it, I don't know exactly the form it's going to take.
You can't know.
And I'm not going to know.
Right. It's not possible to know. And I could give you all sorts of comforts, but I'm not really a comfort kind of guy. I'm a truth guy.
What helps seeing people, I guess part of the inquiry on my interest is seeing like someone like yourself who's talking from where you're talking from, interact in life besides just sitting on a chair.
Uh-huh.
You know, what do you do when, you know, your baby's about to fall off a cliff or something, or does?
I haven't had, number one, I don't have a baby, and luckily it hasn't fallen. I know what happens when I almost fall off a cliff. I used to do a lot of rock climbing, so I'm pretty familiar with that one.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying, though.
You know,
my life to you would be extraordinarily boring, I guarantee it. I am a bore. I hang out and do lots of very unimpressive things. Totally unimpressive things. It's not interesting. You know what I mean? I walk around, I do as much nothing as I can. I go to the movies occasionally. I'll channel surf now and then. I'll invite friends over to play poker and take as much of their money as I possibly can. Occasionally, I'll sit in silence. I eat breakfast, get up in the morning, go to the bathroom. Pretty boring. To me, it's absolutely fantastic. When I'm not doing this, when I'm not in satsang, I basically talk about the truth as little as humanly possible. It's much more fun to live it than to sit around talking about it. And to live it is the simplest thing. It's just walking out in your garden. And it's just feeling the joy of it. It's the simplest things.
That seems more palpable than, at a certain point, all the concepts just become all abstract to me.
They are.
You know?
They're just pointers. Pointers to your true nature. Just pointers. In the same way, a roadmap of New York City is quite different than arriving in downtown Manhattan, isn't it? In one sense, when you get to downtown Manhattan, the roadmap may have helped you get there, but the map and Manhattan are about as different as two things could possibly be. And in the same way, the pointers towards truth, towards your nature, and actually experiencing your true nature are about as different as two things could possibly be. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So in this game, you either have one of two natures, or you might have a mixture of the both. Some people have the nature of trust or faith. That's their way. They just are born with intrinsic trust, intrinsic faith. Their way is trust. They let go because they just trust. They have no reason to trust. They don't necessarily know why they're trust. It's part of their nature just to let go and trust. And that lets them let go. Other people, they have to know. They might not, trust may not be their thing. They've got to know. And so the only way they're going to know, they realize eventually, is to let go and look for themselves. Either way will do. As long as you don't sit around the campfire, basking in its warmth, but never jumping into the fire. Just jump in.
I'm just trying to navigate that fear, really.
There's no navigating it. It's fear, right? Feel it. That's all. It's just fear. Have you not felt afraid a lot of times in your life?
I've felt afraid most of my life.
There you go. So you should be used to it by now.
I'm sick. I'm exhausted.
Right. You go to ask somebody on a date or whatever. You get a little afraid. You have a new job you've never been to. You get a little bit nervous. You almost fall off a cliff.
Just wake up in the morning.
You wake up in the morning. Oh, God, life. The spiritual person's greatest nightmare. Oh, I'm still here.
Yeah,
right.
There's truth to that.
Yes, yeah. I know there's truth.
Everybody wouldn't be laughing, right?
They know. Yeah. I found that for the spiritual personality, most of them are a little more afraid of living than they are of dying. They think they're afraid of dying until they keep running up against living. So fear is your doorway, friend. Fear tells you you are in the vicinity of what's truly worthwhile. It tells you you are in the vicinity of the unknown. You walk through your fear. You enter into your fear through the direct experience of fear to see what's on the other side. Nobody does an end run around it. Everyone thinks because there's fear, there's been a mistake. I'm in the wrong place. I must enter through some other means. How about a little bliss? How about a little joy? Let me manufacture a really good feeling and then I'll let go. But alas, when you get right down to it, you're touching upon an existential fear, right? A fear of not existing and a fear of existing. You're hemmed in on all sides. Talking about the ultimate catch-22. Afraid of living and afraid of dying. You got fear of everything going.
And you grab every moment before it even happens.
Right.
Or right after it happens.
Right.
And you're exhausted.
And why is that fear there? Why is the fear there? Ultimately, in the end, there are lots of reasons. Psychological reasons and otherwise. But in the end, existentially, fear arises because you do not know what you are. You see yourself as separate, and therefore a potential victim to the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. So this is an invitation into the fear, to its source, not in your mind, but in your experience. Do you see what I mean?
You're saying I got to find out. It's the only way to do it.
You got to find out for yourself. I'm just speaking from inside the fear. You see, I'm on the inside of the fear, saying, "Come through. It's fine." You're in the right place. That's why so many people at the bottom of their being, they have fear. It's the right place. What a better door. Everyone pays attention to fear. It's hard to avoid forever. And you walk through, you let yourself go to find out what's on the other side of your ideas about yourself. Just like with my friend who we were just talking to, right? It's the same thing. When you start to look and you see, I don't really know who I am. What could be more frightening? Not only am I afraid of living and confused by life and, you know, the whole thing and death, but I don't even know what I am. I don't even know what I am. I'm dragging around this little personal identity my whole life, adding bits and pieces to it, right? More and more of me all the time knowing it's not really real. all the time knowing, right? No wonder people have bad self-images, because self-images aren't even worthy of having a good one. It's just because of that sneaking suspicion that my image is just an image. And so you start to look for yourself, right? For yourself, because you're the authority, right? I'm not the authority of your experience. You are. You look for yourself. You look behind your ideas of yourself. You meet the nothingness that's there. And then you come back and you tell me what you find. It's an experiment. You got to be a little bit of a crazy scientist.
Yeah, and the odds aren't so good from what you're selling, huh?
Hmm?
You're saying the success rate isn't that high.
Oh, don't worry about that. You can't be caught up in all that.
I know.
Right. That's another way of avoiding. Right?
No, you just got to want to run the race. Or
you just
climb the hill or something.
Or not. Or stop running the race and stop climbing the hill and stop doing everything you think you need to do and meet your experience directly as it is. Why have so many people failed historically, even though they put great effort? People that have dedicated their whole lives, left their families and friends all behind, shaved their heads, put on the robes, meditated their whole life, and when the casket closed, they still didn't know who they were. Why? Because the chances are infinitesimally small? No. That's not why. Because it's difficult? No. That's not why either. Simply because they've never started from where they are right now. That's the secret door, where you are right now. You right now are a mystery unto yourself right now. You look inside for yourself outside of an idea and a thought and a feeling, and you can't find a self. Right now, before you've meditated, before you spent 100 years in an ashram, you can see things that people have spent their whole lives dedicated to this have never seen. Why haven't they seen it? Mostly because somebody with half a brain of good sense did not come up to them, shake them by the shoulders, and say, look, let's just look at this very simply. Simply. Honestly. Directly. It's not difficult. Do you get the sense of it?
Yeah.
It's not difficult. It's just so easy. It's so simple. That's why people miss it. It's so simple.
It's a little like Braille. You're going somewhere you don't know, but you...
That's right. But you go anyway. It's a journey. It's an adventure. It's the ultimate adventure.
Thanks.
Enjoy yourself. Come on. Come on up. I'll come to you next, okay? All right. I was going to let you two decide, but...
Good morning, Adya.
Good morning.
My name is Katie.
Hi, Katie.
Hi.
Yeah.
So I'd like to get back to the neurotic stuff.
Okay.
And I think you've already answered my question at least 100 times this morning, probably a couple hundred times yesterday. There's this self in my psychology, or the psychology in this form, that that since yesterday I'm calling my New York cab driver.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't show up driving so much, but it shows up in the need to be right.
Ah, yes.
Ah, yes. Which...
That's a familiar one, isn't it?
Oh, so.
Yes.
Which can look like needing to get there first. in its two extremes are defending when there's a perceived threat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so pushing against.
Right.
Or relishing the victory.
Yes, relishing yes. being right.
Yeah, like yes. Winning a game of Scrabble is like a dose of heroin, you know? Until it wears off, of course.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, because to the me, it affirms everything about the me, doesn't it? The total affirmation.
It's wonderful.
I'm better, smarter, and I beat you.
Mm-hmm. It's fake bliss.
Yes, yes.
And so, like many folks were speaking yesterday, this aspect, it's not working anymore.
It's very good you know that.
However, I mean, more and more it feels like poison, you know, in my bloodstream.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that I'm like Amy yesterday trying to be who I was, but it pops up, you know, like a jack in the box or something. Just, you know, lately, the last few months I've kind of felt like Wonder Woman on steroids or something, you know, kind of just deflecting. Anything, everything.
That sounds interesting, huh? So what's your question for me?
So my question is, to the degree that I abide as the witness,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I know this is different for everyone and you can't really tell me, but will the springs on the jack-in-box wear off?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, or, you know, I hear you saying this morning, surrender, you know, allow it to be as it is, mm-hmm. and yet this is becoming just another thing I have to do.
Yes, mm-hmm. and that you might do right.
And that, by golly, I might do right.
Yes. mm-hmm. But you won't. You will fail at it. You'll fail at doing it right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've always failed at doing it right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. This isn't so much a matter of a technique. You see? Getting beyond one's sort of neurotic patterns by means of some wise technique. It's not technique.
Mm-mm.
It's seeing very clearly, letting yourself see. In the same way, it's not a technique when you realize that when you touch a hot stove, you don't have to be taught how to take your hand away.
Right? Thank goodness.
Right. You know it's hot. You know there's nothing in it for you to keep your hand on the stove. And so you immediately, your hand gets taken off the stove before you even know. When you see that these images we have of ourselves, this image of being right, the one to be right, that they're all a defense mechanism against nothingness.
Mm-hmm. And that's what feels so crazy right now.
Yes.
Is so clearly in having a deep knowing and experience that there is nothing that can be hurt.
Right.
And yet the jack in the box just keeps, mm-hmm. it just feels like it's getting flushed as the veil kind of drops.
It does get flushed mm-hmm. as the veil drops. Mm-hmm. Everyone thinks, oh, it's just immediately going to disappear. No, no, no. Very often, whatever's unresolved gets flushed out, gets flushed up, it becomes more obvious, much more obvious. Mm-hmm. And then when it gets to become more obvious, you'll think, oh, it'll never let go. But it must become mm-hmm. much more obvious.
And there's much this more. Extreme resistance to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is futile, of course.
Your mind knows that.
Mm-hmm.
Does your heart know?
Mm-hmm. More importantly.
That's what's more important.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's more important. You see, because look, there's many times for you, for us, for everyone in this room, where we did not get what we wanted. Right? many times. From a very young age, when we did not get what we wanted, when we did not get what we thought or felt we needed. And so a pattern gets set up. Being right is a way of getting what I want. Acknowledgement, love, nurturing, right? Even if it's only to nurture yourself from being right. Even if it's only a moment of being able to approve of yourself by being right. These patterns just get set up very, very early on. And when you start to see that all these patterns are ultimately various ways that we turned away from ourself. That's how the pattern gets stuck, because we turn away from ourself.
And the resistance is more turning away.
Is more turning away, right. More and more and more turning away. So just turn towards what you've turned away from. You see, because the opposite, the other side of I must be right and therefore be justified and feel a sense of goodness about myself, when you look just on the other side of that, not in opposition, but on the other side of it, there's a tremendous innocence, the innocence that you turned away from when you didn't get what you wanted or needed. You turned away from what was most beautiful and sublime and satisfying about yourself.
And I don't need to prove that.
You don't need to prove that. Because all you need to see is that you did it. Innocently, totally innocently. Nobody did it to you. Someone may not have given you what you wanted or needed, but nobody made you turn away from yourself. We all do that on our own, totally, totally innocently. And when you start to see that you did it, and you do it, and nobody else. And you just turn back towards that which you turn away from. You see, because when you turn back, there's something very innocent there, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Something very undefended.
Mm-hmm.
Something soft and bright. The mind has a memory that which is soft and bright and innocent and beautiful can be harmed or taken away. But you look again, because in the moment, it's not taken away. It never was taken away. It wasn't damaged. It couldn't be damaged. It's impossible to be damaged. Everything your mind thought about it never happened. You as you are were never damaged, you weren't harmed, you weren't hurt, not as you really are. You thought you were, and so you turned away. So you turn back towards. Do you feel what I'm talking about inside?
Absolutely.
And there's your beauty, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There's a richness, there's a beauty there.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to win, and you didn't have to be right.
No, it's this place of not needing to be loved, but
right.
Being to be love.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, might that remnant reemerge at some times? Might. Don't be surprised by it. But when it reemerges, there's the next opportunity. Not to resist it, to just realize you can turn back towards what you just in that moment turned away from,
mm-hmm.
right? So those become doorways. As soon as that pattern comes back up, you feel, oh, right at this moment, there was a spontaneous turning away from what was beautiful and whole and satisfying. And then you just turn back towards it.
Mm-hmm.
So then even our neurosis, my teacher used to say, we come to nirvana by the way of samsara. We don't come to nirvana, we don't come to enlightenment through our beautiful, shining, understandings. You know, that's not. We come to nirvana through way of samsara.
That seems to be the case.
Yes.
And I see how a lot of my reaction has been to psychologize it, to spiritualize it.
Right.
And I feel incredibly tired of doing that.
Yes. Because, see, we're not spiritualizing it or psychologizing it. We're, I'm simply speaking to you on the just the level of experience. This is the level we're just talking on, the level of experience. Turning away isn't a psychological or a spiritual thing. It's just an experiential thing. You can feel. It happened, and it keeps happening. Turning back towards what's beautiful isn't psychological, and it's not spiritual. It's not a story. You're not working out your non-existent dilemma. You're just turning back. And it's experiential, isn't it? So you haven't left yourself. You haven't disappeared into any intellectual context. As they say, we come back to ourselves by the same route that we left ourselves. When we turned away, the way we come back is to turn back towards. We left one way, we come back the same way, but isn't in the opposite direction.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me know how it goes. Yeah. And then in the end, it also helps to have a real lightness of spirit about it. You know, we get so surprised when some pattern reemerges. God, I can't believe that. Why not? It's been happening forever. Why are you so surprised? We get so surprised. What a form of arrogance to be surprised about what's been occurring for the last, you know, whatever, 20, 30 years. When you stop being surprised, there's such a vast inner space to maneuver in. You're not surprised, you're not ashamed, you're not in judgment, you're just, there it is. Why be surprised? Okay. Enjoy your day.